Thank you for tuning in to the Movie Geeks United Slam Dance Spotlight on Pete Smalls Is Dead, which tells the story of a former screenwriter turned downtrodden East Coast laundromat owner who finds himself back in Los Angeles when his dog Buddha is kidnapped by loan sharks. The film has a stellar cast from Steve Buscemi, Tim Roth, to star Peter Dinklage, who joins in this conversation with director and co-screenwriter Alexander
Rockwell.
Premiered, if I'm not mistaken, last night. Tell me about that experience.
You want to go for it, Peter?
It was great. I mean, it was packed. It was lovely. There was I didn't see the short film that preceded ours, but I heard that was really good. And you know, Slam Dance is sort of in the spirit of what Sundance used to be, and I like that.
Yeah, it's actually great. It was, you know, when you open the doors at the end, it was like a waft of, you know, of lack of, you know, what's the opposite of oxygen? I don't know. Would plants breathe? Anyway, it was like if you were a plant, you would have loved it because there was no oxygen in that room. But it was packed, and there should have been a few screenings. But they, you know, we were honored to be the opening night film.
Mm. And Alexander, it's particularly for you, what is it like? Because this is the world premiere of the film last night, wasn't it? It hasn't played at any other festivals.
You know, it's to me, it actually, it had shown in Europe, but okay. It was the domestic premiere, and that's the big thing. But no, it was not the world premiere.
Well, what is it like when you see your film that you've lived with for so long through an audience's eyes for the first time?
It's amazing. It's a wonderful. It's like seeing your daughter score her first basket in a basketball game. You realize that you never thought it was going to happen, but eventually it'll happen. And it was basically, my daughter doesn't play basketball very well, but hear this. For she's only seven, okay? Cut her some slack. Hey, listen, but when we did the you know movie, you know you're so just trying to keep your head above water on these kind of independent films that. You never really envision a moment like last night when you just give it away to an audience and they take it. It's a wonderful feeling. It's really, really wonderful.
Do you learn, and I guess this question can apply to both of you guys, do you learn anything new about your film by experiencing it with an audience for the first time?
Well, you know, I'm going to let Peter talk because I talk too much, but I just want to say quickly, you know what? Honestly, I feel like I do, but I think it's a big mistake to do that because every audience is different. And if you get too, I mean, we happened to have a great screening last night, which was just great. But every audience can be different, and you can't let you got to be solid, man. You got to know your work's good. You got to go in there with, you know, your actors and be confident because if you get hurt by a bad screening, it's almost as bad as being too impressed with a good screening. You just kind of have to, you know, it's a wonderful feeling, and especially when, you know, when it's positive. But I would not say I learned. I don't want to alter the way I work because of how an audience took it. How do you think, Pete?
I don't learn a thing. I just learned that. I love the movie I made with Alex. I'm very happy with it. So an audience's reaction either way is great, or they don't like it. Everybody's critic lately and everybody's opinionated, and that's fine too, but I'll forever have the experience and my love of the movie itself. So, you know, I don't know if I learn anything really. I just sort of enjoy being there and sharing the movie.
Yeah. Well, I read a quote from you, Peter, that you said at film festivals you like to hide. Are you uncomfortable in that environment?
An hour ago. Yeah, you know, I hide sometimes a lot, you know. I don't know.
He's not hiding now.
I'm not hiding now.
he's laying down on a bed right next to me. That's not hiding. And you know what?
I'm so fully clothed. I'm wearing a three-piece suit, basically. There's a lot that's sort of I'm good with my friends, but the schmoozing and the whole thing, and you know, it's almost a cliche that to talk about that stuff in terms of film festivals. But you know, you walk around and it's some sort of entity beyond the film themselves. And unfortunately, a lot of these things are all about that and money and selling products and stuff. And I just shy away from that stuff. Not to paint myself as some tortured artist, but I'm just sort of shy no matter what, unless I'm around my good friends. So I don't do really well in public situations like this.
Yeah.
That's what I was referring to.
Well, Alexander, you've made a statement that independent film is not what it used to be. And I'm curious to know from you what spirit you think isn't as prevalent as...
I so wish I hadn't said
that. Poor kids.
You know, sometimes I don't want to be honest. No, you know what it is it's a little bit of nostalgia, you know, from a guy who blossomed at a time when it was a real splurge of independent energy and support, incidentally, by the way, in terms of financing for independent film. So I was spoiled and I came to life at that time. And I just thought it would just keep happening like that. I always thought that, you know, me and my buddies would all just be caught forever making films, and it would be, you know, we didn't need to make bigger films. We just wanted to make the, you know, off-center kind of, it was almost like rock and roll. It's almost like, you know, music. It was like we didn't have to, you know, we didn't have to go huge. We just wanted to make our, you know, our smaller albums that appeal to a very, you know, specific group of people and have fun. We thought they would just keep going on. And then I think what happened is independent film became a brand. It became this brand name, Sundance, an independent film. And it started to become a marketing brand. And I think that kind of took away, for me, it started to, you know, people are, in a way, I guess what I meant by that is that people are trying to appeal to the brand of independent filmmaking rather than being truly motivated for the love of working together and making films. Like Peter mm-hmm. Dinklage here, who, you know, he doesn't always work with me, he works with other great independent directors who have that same feeling, Steve Buscemi and this, you know, this cadre of independent actors and filmmakers who came out of that truly independent time. I think we're all a little nostalgic about that time.
Yeah. Well, I love the film. I thought it was really engaging from start to finish, and I love movies where I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next, because so many films are carbon copies of everything you've already seen before, and this movie is completely fresh. So I'm curious to know what the genesis of this film was.
You actually, you know, reiterated what I said, which is that I think there's a reason why they're generic and they're formulaic and they don't cross genres, because essentially people are trying to appeal to a market. So they make comedies, quote, comedies, like knucklehead comedies. And by the way, I love knucklehead comedies. I'm an old Three Stooges fan from years ago. And, you know, I love knucklehead comedies, but you know, we can do it all. We can, you know, we can make somebody laugh and cry and whatever, and we can get engaged and be thoughtful and, you know, we can write good dialogue. It doesn't mean, you know, just a comedy doesn't have to have stupid dialogue. And I like being surprising an audience, because who knows, the best parts of life are when you walk out the door and bang, you meet the woman you'll marry when you didn't even know you would, you know. It life mm-hmm. goes, you know, surprises.
Yeah. So Peter, when you heard this idea or received the script, what appealed to you about it, and what particularly appealed to you about the character of KC?
I'm getting a bit older now. I have sort of a lot in common with that guy. My edges are a little bit singed, you know, as is KC's, and I have a sort of a deep romance and love for what I do, but also a cynicism towards it, and I've turned my back on a lot of things that might have been lucrative or might not have been, and I think Casey has done that as well. And but with that comes a price, you know. There's a loneliness price, and I learned that as well, and I really sort of associated with that, and it struck a chord with me in the script when I read it and talked to Alex about it. When I was younger, I played like the crazier parts, like the sort of the jack roles in this movie, and I don't know. I think I'm I get a little more drawn to these characters that are a bit more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Once in a while, you need to play them just as many times as you need to play the wacky characters, you know.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because the journey that this film takes is at times it's kind of an absurdist ride, and you act as a real anchor in the film. And was that a delicate balance to get right tonally?
Yeah, you know, I just trust Alex. I mean, in many ways, those roles are a bit more tricky than the wacky doodle characters on the fringes, because you are responsible to sort of keep it at an even keel. You know, you need that to keep that sort of audience temperature gauged at a certain temperature, and I don't know. It's I find it a bit more challenging, and I'm all up for that as an actor. You know, as an actor, I'm also I like to do a variety of different things. Alex's next movie, maybe you know, hopefully I'll play like a crazy over the top character wearing a wig. You know, I like it up.
Pete's really good at that. He's really good at it. Not every actor can do internal stuff that reads in a close up. It's hard, man. It's really hard to be still. And, you know, and it's interesting because both Pete and I like literature. We, you know, I heard his references of, you know, Bukowski or John Fonte, you know, the kind of the internal, you know, the kind of like these guys who kind of kick around L.A. in the lower, you know, kind of like the unlit L.A., the, you know, when all the tinsel has been turned off on the tree. And it's kind of like we like the characters. And when you read those books, it's all internal monologue. I mean, they don't talk. I mean, they hardly ever, you know, they might say hello to some waitress who they've got a mad crush on or you know, they may grunt as they fall off a bar stool. So basically, it's all their internal stuff. So that, you know, Pete had to do that. And we have those references. I mean, we didn't have to talk a lot about it. We get it. He gets me. Like, you know, we both love dogs, for instance. We both die for dogs. You know, we're just that. That's just something you get or you don't get. And I never had to say, you know, I never had to tell Pete once that like, you know, man, he's going to.
I don't get it. Why am I going to care about the dog?
His girl's so beautiful. Why does he still care about the dog? You know, like, why is he turning down the money? I mean, you want the dog. You know, why, you know, you want the dog.
I often sometimes have to say, wait, what about the dog?
Yeah. And then Pete, and I remember talking to a lot of people going like, you know, man, why did he go all the way to L.A. to get a dog? And I was like, And then Pete and I always understood that about each other. We always got that internal absurdist irony, which on one level I just love dogs. I mean, it's just simple, but it's also there is sort of a sweetness and kind of a humor in a man who's living to find his dog. You know, it that means he's down to his last emotional nickel. You know, and this is what he's holding on to.
What emotional nickel?
What was the shooting schedule on this? How long did you have to shoot?
It was actually really nice. It was probably about 30 shooting days.
Yeah.
Because of everybody's schedules and stuff, we had to work around some stuff. So we took a couple weeks off, and then we shot the end of the movie a couple weeks later. Or parts of the end of the movie a couple weeks later because of people's, you know, everybody. You know, everybody on this movie is a great actor, so their lives and schedules, their work schedules are complicated. So we sort of had to weave and work around some of those, but it all worked out in the end. So we're probably shot in about a month.
Well, yeah, it's a stunning cast, absolutely.
Yeah,
and as you know, you liked the film and you saw the film, it goes a lot. I mean, there's so many exterior locations. I mean, we moved, we went from Mexico to... You know, every bit of the underbelly of L.A., and we went on locations, and we shot downtown, we shot out in the Salton Sea, and we shot, you know, the last ending in Mexico, we shot in Mexico, but we also shot in one area, in one place we shot, you know, I think we shot in a nightclub on Sunset Boulevard, we went out to Salton Sea, we went down to Mexico, so we shot, you know, like, we scrambled and shot. I was very lucky on a low-budget film to have hit so many locations.
But there was such freedom in that, because if one location wasn't ready, we would just immediately jump to something else. Like there's a scene with Boone and I on the moped. Yeah. Boone and I spent a lot of time on that moped because we kept adding more and more stuff and other stuff that we could accommodate given the schedule. So there's a lot of, even though our budget is very limited, there was a certain amount of freedom to what we could do, which was really lovely.
That's exactly what I was curious about, and I'll let you go after I ask this because I know you guys are very busy. But with independent film, obviously, you're always fighting for more money and more time. But that kind of situation, does it lend itself more to creative solutions?
Oh yeah, completely. I've said it before. The lovely thing about doing these independent films, at least this one, is things are solved creatively rather than financially because you're not given the choice, really. And I think a lot of things in Hollywood are solved financially, and that's when you get into the, things that are, become sort of mediocre material. You know, I think not enough things are solved creatively. And I think when you're not given a choice, that sometimes it can be a blessing.
I actually would add to that. I would say I'd love to make a T-shirt and give it out as swag on Main Street that said, "People make films, not money." And yeah, I probably wouldn't be the most popular swag item. But you know, I think that. But you know, I mean, I really do believe that. I believe that you know, we do our best work when we kind of have a solution to come up with it. You know, it's the hunter gatherer in all of us. You know, it's like, ugh, how do we cross river? Me take stick and hit you on head and swim. You know, it's like, you know.
Or no, wait, me pay you $1 million for nice raft.
Oh, smart idea. What is $1 million? No, but you know, like, in other words, we're at our best when we're problem solving. Hey, I know we're going to go, and I just want to say one last thing, you know, from my point of view. That, you know, we started out the conversation by talking about the state of independent film, and it's alive and well at Slam Dance. I think that Slam Dance is you know, really doing, you know, they're really dedicated to helping filmmakers come together and talk about independent film, and they haven't had to have that big push that Sundance has had to have sponsorship, so they really kind of stayed clean, and I really love their energy. I love, you know, I wish their projection rooms were a little better, but I love their kind of their wild energy and the fact that they really are keeping the independent spirit alive. I was very honored to have had the opening night.